Hello, and welcome to this new version of Tales from the Heart. We're still working on the working name for these segments, but I like our patient journeys or our share your stories in podcast form. So today we are joined by our first patient story in the 2024 season 4 Tales from the Heart Share Your Story chapter. And we're going to talk a little bit about real life with HCM, what it's like to be diagnosed, what it's like to evaluate management options, and what life with HCM is really like for one of our ambassadors. And Mayer, why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey and how you got diagnosed with HCM to start off with?
Okay. Hi, Lisa. I'm Mayer Bianchi. Thanks for having me on. My diagnosis journey began incidentally in 2022. Sorry. Yeah, it's been a while. 2022, I was 36 years old, or right before I turned 36. I had a routine physical with a new doctor here in New Jersey. This had never been unbeknownst to me prior. He discovered a heart murmur when listening to my heart with a stethoscope. And then he said, "Hey, I hear you have a murmur. Did you know you have a murmur?" And I was like, "No, I did not know that. Nobody ever told me this." So, you know, through many years of routine physicals, this had never been caught. Perhaps it got progressively worse. But then, he referred me for an EKG. And then that was like, okay, you should get an echo. So I went for an echocardiogram at the local cardiologist that was affiliated with the primary care doctor's practice. And then that echo detected the HCM in terms of the thickened left ventricle wall, the septal wall, and, you know, indicated there was an issue and the obstruction. I had the obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And so then I opted to get an MRI to get a further resolution on the problem. And then from there, it was, you know, definitively stated, hey, you have this condition. I knew nothing about it. And then I was referred to a center for excellence in Morristown. And that's where I started working with an HCM specialist. And that was my diagnosis journey.
So it went pretty quickly for you from the identification of the murmur to the appropriate testing and to a referral to a high volume center. So that,
yeah,
at least in New Jersey, we got the system working the way it should. So that wasn't a big delay for you.
Yes. But, and I would say that there was also genetic testing after that to further confirm.
And they were able to identify a gene in your family and in you?
Yeah, the MYH7 gene, which is linked to obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I tested positive for that as well. So that helped identify with even more certainty, not that it wasn't sure that I had it, but that, you know, it's inherited and that I should get the rest of my family checked.
Fantastic.
So okay. You were saying, I apologize.
No problem. Podcasting is conversational. We go back and forth. So that diagnostic journey, when you were diagnosed and they told you that there was something structurally wrong with your heart, You were 36-ish. And looking back, did you notice any symptoms or things that you may have just taken for granted as being normal or a little uncomfortable? What did you notice about the past?
So much. So having the diagnosis and becoming able to understand what the disease was and what it was causing answered a lot of the questions and concerns that I had about myself since I was a late teens, early 20s, when I started having these kind of symptoms. And I thought it was more because of my lifestyle or because I wasn't in the best shape. And, you know, like, why couldn't I ever keep up when going running with friends? Or why did I have such a difficult time exercising? Even though I enjoyed exercising, I enjoyed playing sports, I enjoyed doing things, but they didn't, you know, my body didn't enjoy it, or I didn't feel competent or capable. And then, you know, I began to learn that there was other like psychological symptoms and stuff that maybe I don't quite have a deep understanding of yet, but it just, so much, right? Like so much of things that I thought were my personality or whatever were really down to my physiology. And that was kind of eye-opening. And that was part of, wow, you know, like this is really an eye-opener. And so to me, that was one of the most shocking and, you know, stages of grief-inducing aspects of being diagnosed with the condition, was because it put so much in perspective and it all happened at once.
Great points. We're going to unpack it a little for our listeners. So HCM causes the heart to become stiff and thick and can impede the ability of the blood to leave the left ventricle. That's obstruction. So big fancy words for thick, stiff heart that doesn't let blood out properly, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy with obstruction. So that's kind of the layman's understanding. So you're told that you have this structural problem with your heart. And then as you're thinking back to your earlier years, those teens and 20 years where we're all pushing the envelope and we think we're, you know, gonna be perfect every day, and you're finding that you're not keeping up with your peers. Did you ever discuss that with your doctors or family, or did you just think it was you?
I thought it was me. I also thought it was because of maybe some of the lifestyle choices I was making, like in terms of, you know, like keeping healthy or not being like being overweight or, you know, certain other things that probably didn't help to the problem. But I don't think those were, you know, like it exacerbated the symptoms. And then also as I got older, it was getting worse, I would say as well, like as in more physical manifestations of it, like fatigue, or, you know, I actually had a lot of issues with fatigue or being tired and, you know, like I'm like certain things that I didn't never put two and two together on. But then even as a later adult, you know, closer to when at the time I got diagnosed, I would start to get wiped more after doing something strenuous or like, you know, combined with COVID-19 and that whole situation, like being out of breath times two, you know, or things like that. Like it really, it all kind of coalesced, I would say. And so I would just say that things started to make sense because it was getting progressively worse, that maybe the murmur got more significant. I don't really know, you know, but.
So what happens over time, to unpack the why at 36, as you age, your mitral valve is typically a little bit elongated and abnormal in HCM. And when that mitral valve gets a little floppier and it makes contact with the septum, the muscle that separates the right and the left ventricle, the obstruction can actually get worse as you age. So it's not uncommon for the age of diagnosis to be around 40, because your body's just aging and now the obstruction has gotten worse. And we see this in a lot of people.
That makes a lot of sense.
Your experience is very normal, as is the ability to look back in time and say, oh, those days where I couldn't run up the stairs with my friends after we went out and had a drink or two and had a dinner, why did I get so winded then? Oh, because you had an HCM heart.
Or why did I feel so terrible after drinking a large cup of water after eating a meal? Like that was something that a symptom that would keep happening to me in the years before I was diagnosed. I would go out to eat, obviously eat maybe a lot or whatever, but then I'd be thirsty, drink a big cup of water, and then feel like I was dying for like 2 hours afterwards, you know, like.
So this is a very common symptom in HCM. And I think it's great that we're discussing it in the podcast, that hopefully other patients can hear this and go, oh, this is making sense to me.
Yeah. It's like a signal that you didn't know was there. Yeah.
So when you eat food, your body must metabolize it. So your gut requires more blood. So the blood is diverted from the heart and into the gut to process food. And when your gut is processing food, your heart is a bit dehydrated. It doesn't have the volume it needs. So you're going to feel your symptoms a little bit worse when you have a full gut. And so large meals are really not great for people with HCM. We want to eat smaller, lighter meals because it's less taxing on the system. So this is a very common symptom, and people don't necessarily say, oh, I'm a little tired after I ate, or I'm a little short of breath. Maybe there's something wrong with my heart. But maybe that should be a hint for some people to discuss that symptom with their doctors.
Yeah, and also something you said was interesting, because I was also saying I felt thirsty. And so like if you said your heart is dehydrated, is that something that can make you feel thirsty in the moment or not as much?
Not typically.
Or that could be a product of eating salty food or something. Like
that could be the salty food. But then when you're putting all of that fluid in your gut, your gut still has to process that fluid.
Yeah, so adding the water just is like, yeah, that's what I felt like the water would be, even though I wanted to drink water, which is healthy, that would be the thing that would like push it over the edge or something.
Very common in that time. You know, if you're just talking about drinking water and getting that way, that's not kind of it, but it's the food and it's
no, it was definitely the food first. Exactly.
Food and the water. Yeah. So those are common and that makes obstruction worse.
Mm-hmm.
So if your heart is dehydrated and you're obstructed, that makes it have to work even harder. So that's when you're going to feel your most symptoms. So we got you to a diagnosis. We got you to a center of excellence. They got you genetic testing. We have all of the anatomy, physiology figured out. So then you were left with some decisions on treatment. And you were in obstructed HCM with a gradient. I believe it was over 100. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. It was definitely high 80s. I don't know if it was over 100, but it was high.
It was around that 100 area, my memory is telling me. So you have an obstruction and there is anatomical reasons why surgery was presented to you.
It wasn't just presented in that way. Like there was a couple steps in between and I was pretty aggressive about this. Like I'm the kind of person where it's like, once I know something and if I have the means to deal with it, I'm going to attack the problem. And so that was, you know, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to work with a physician to do that because then it allowed me to expedite the process. But I would say there was a stress echo involved where I went to have a stress echo. And then that stress echo, it really confirmed the level of obstruction and when I get exhausted and, you know, go through, you know, respiratory distress or whatever that's called. Like when you, when you start exercising, you get so out of breath that you have to stop. That was proven to me at that moment. And the doctor was like, look, you can lose all the weight in the world. You can become a vegan. You can do this. You can do that. It will never stop the symptoms of this. You either need to go on this new drug called mavacamten, or you need to have a surgery, you know, or surgery is one of the options. Because previous to that, in the visits with this doctor, they were like not suggesting that I have surgery. You know, they weren't pushing that option. They were saying, oh, go on a beta blocker, do this. The typical standard of care that's been there for so many years up until last year for obstructive HCM, which is beta blockers, hope for the best, live a good lifestyle because you don't have any other options, right? Or the septal myectomy when it gets really bad. And so for me personally, I was apprehensive about pharmacological solutions. And so I was like, hey, give me the surgery. If we can fix this mechanically, sign me up. And that was obviously really intense because it's open heart surgery. Like once you hear like, this is real deal, open heart, split you open like a clam, you know, surgery, not like, oh, an incision, you know, it was actual, you know, open heart surgery and you're doing it on purpose, not because you had a cardiac emergency, like because you're choosing to do it. So to me, that was the option that was presented and it was really emotional. My wife was with me. It was like another moment of grief or another moment of like fear, a lot of fear involved. I'm a parent. So it was like, you know, making decisions that were selfish versus selfless versus trying to improve yourself so you can help others. It was like a swirl of that. And then on top of it, this was also with the knowledge that like my condition, my specific personal presentation of the disease wasn't going to kill me sudden cardiac arrest. It was going to make my heart fail more and more over time to where maybe in the future I might need a transplant or I don't know, you know? And so those fears were swirling through my mind because I was like, hey, I'm 36. I'm not getting any younger. I was 30. Yeah, I guess I was 36 at the time or 37. Yeah, no, I was 37 by that point. But it's all a blur right now. So I was 37 because this was 2022. Yeah, so 2022. So I was 37 and I was like, I'm not getting any younger. And therefore I need to, I need to basically do something about this because I was more afraid of what would happen later, right? Like what, if I didn't do something about it, what were my long-term prognosis? Since I was already, you know, happy to hear that, hey, you're not at risk of sudden cardiac death, which unfortunately is not the case for a lot of people. And I was fortunate because maybe I didn't find out for so long, but that's because I didn't have that risk. And unfortunately, a lot of people do. So I'll stop there and say, that's what the decision-making calculus that went into it was all those factors swirling through my mind.
So you looked at all of that. You and I talked a little bit through that time. And
yeah, that's when I actually met you in October of that year, of 2022.
Yeah. So yeah. We talked about options, and you went back and you met with your team and you decided to go ahead with the myectomy. I know it was scary. It is not fun to have a thoracotomy. I've had one, and have your chest cracked open and have to recover from that. But it's, for some people, it's all they ever need for a therapy, and they do really well for 20 plus years, and maybe other things creep up over time, but the myectomy can be highly effective. But for you, 6 months out, you're like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. I didn't get the ta-da, I'm better now.
What was worse than that? Imagine 10 days out. Like, mm-hmm. I went through the open heart surgery, made it out alive, which is already an amazing accomplishment. You know, shout outs to the care team and the surgical team and the hospital team, because I was able to miraculously, you know, go have open heart surgery on a Monday and be home on that same Friday. So that was already, you know, wonderful. And then, but then I had my follow-up echo 10 days later. And when I was told in the hospital during surgery, oh, my gradient's down, your heart's not obstructed, it was an amazing success, we're so pumped. So I left, you know, and that probably helped me psychologically get out the hospital and be motivated. I was doing my rehab, walking already and everything. Then I was devastated when 10 days later I hear, oh, you still have a bad gradient. I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's because I'm still on recovery, I'm on opioids, I'm not feeling good, whatever. 3 months later, had the second echo, still bad results. And that's when it was really depressing, because from there I was just like, oh, this was a failure, this didn't work. My surgery wasn't successful. And then that elicited a whole new chain of grief, because I was like, you know, I can't believe I did damage to my heart, damage to my body by doing surgery. Like, you know, as in, just for the record, when you get a septal myectomy, it damages the electrical signals in the left side of your heart for this specific surgery. So that way, if my right side later got damaged, the it's called a left branch bundle blockage.
Yeah.
And that is, if the right side happened, then I would need a pacemaker. Whereas before the surgery, I had none of those issues, right? So I took a risk to get a gain of function. And at that moment, I didn't get it. So I was pretty distraught. And then became the next step of the process, which was exploring other options, because now I was also on beta blockers, which I wasn't on before. And that was helping lower my heart rate, but it wasn't fixing the obstruction. And so that's when we started to, you know, the doctor brought up again, mavacamten, Camzyos, and was like, hey, you should look into this. And I was like, no, I'm not sure. And then I hesitated for a while. And then I started to like do more exercise and try to say, hey, I can't control what's happened. I can only control what's going to happen going forward. And that's when I started to exercise more and just think about things differently. And then eventually decide to take the drug.
So you've been on labeled indication. So I'm going to be very specific about this. So there's still clinical trials that are underway in myosin inhibitors. Mavacamten is a myosin inhibitor. There's another company that's got a clinical trial in a myosin inhibitor called aficamten. That company is Cytokinetics. You are on the labeled indication, first in class drug from Bristol Myers Squibb, under the brand name of Camzyos, the drug name of mavacamten. And you've been on it for about 2 months now.
Yep.
And you just had your second echo yesterday.
Yep.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm tired because of other life reasons, but I got an echo the day I started the drug as like a test, right? To see, hey, where are my stats at? Because it was March, and then this was now November, and I hadn't had one for a while. So I was like, I want to see exactly where I'm at. And my gradient was in the 70s. My ejection fraction was in the 70s, still very much obstructed. I had just been to the doctor as being evaluated to go on the drug. And like, he was using me as a textbook heart murmur with another doctor who's becoming a specialist in the field. Like, hey, listen to this guy's heart. It's a murmur. Like, you hear how prominent that murmur is. And it was just like, man, like at least that's going on. So anyway, I started taking the drug in November. And after the first check-in, it already dramatically lowered my gradient. And then after the second check-in, my heart is now working as a normal heart should in terms of obstruction. Like, my gradient's below 10 at rest, below 16 at Valsalva. I mean, below 20 at Valsalva, which is equivalent to what a person without HCM, how their blood flow of their heart is in the left ventricle.
So we've abolished the gradient with two therapies. We've anatomically changed the heart with a myectomy. Wasn't enough, or the geometry of the heart altered and you still had obstruction. And now with the myosin inhibitor on top of that, you've brought the gradient down. The ejection fraction is still in what would be a normal heart range, 55 to 65%, but much lower than it was, less force than it had prior, and the symptoms have improved. Now, you're still early days. You're just two months in.
So things could still change or whatever,
We got some more time to figure this out, but there could even be more changes coming down the line to the positive. We've seen people who are taking myosin inhibitors long-term have a normalization in some cases of their EKG so that the electrical system starts to work more normally. Yes, you have a surgically induced left bundle branch block, which on its own shouldn't cause any negative consequence. We could hopefully see more improvement because of myosin inhibitor. So we're in 2024 now. This is for it's January. Happy New Year to everybody. If you're listening later, that won't mean anything. Fast
yet slow.
I actually just said that this morning in another podcast. We're moving very quickly, but I feel like we're going very slowly. I don't know why.
Like I feel like the year is off to like 100 miles an hour, but I'm like, oh wait, it's only the fifth. But then I know I'm going to wake up and it's going to be the 25th one day. It's
time goes fast. This is for sure. And you've got a new drug on board and hopefully it's going to help you feel better and it's going to improve your quality of life even more so. But that's only part of living with HCM. So we're normalizing the heart and we're taking care of the very important anatomical issues related to HCM, but HCM hits more than just your heart. It hits your figurative heart because it's something that impacts your family as well, both because your health impacts them, but this is genetic. So we know that you have five children. Your kids each have a chance of having HCM.
Yes, unfortunately.
What's the emotional part of that for you? This is all new to you. You've been through a lot in the last 2 years, but then adding on the kids.
Let me tell you. So I'll use the analogy of the genetic lottery. I received my numbers from the genetic lottery in getting HCM, where it was passed to me through my maternal lineage, I think. And, you know, my grandfather apparently had this condition, but nobody told me and I didn't know. So there was the whole part of first, hey, an opportunity was missed to get me help earlier in life, which materially, I don't know what difference it would have made, but it might have. Meaning ignorance is bliss sometimes. But second of all, when I found out you have a 50% chance, so a 1 in 2 chance of passing this to your offspring. And I already had 5 offspring by the time I discovered it. So I felt genetically irresponsible. But when I found out the markers, you know, the situation with my kids, I felt fortunate because through the genetic testing, we were able to find out the status. And I'm trying to not disclose too much because I want to give my kids their own privacy and everything else. But I will just say that the most fortunate aspect about this is now my children, should they have this or have the markers for this, are now going to get the top standard of care from puberty, from the beginning of when the disease typically develops. They will not suffer going through 36 years, 37 years of life without knowing. And that brings me joy. And that makes me a little emotional because that is, to me, the best I can do as a parent in this scenario. And so I would say that's why I'm so passionate now about encouraging people to get screened. And it's better to not live in ignorance because you can make a difference in someone's life that is very close to you or a friend or a family member or your own children. And so that's why it's like the responsible thing to do is to be on top of it, even if it's uncomfortable. And that's, for me, it's heavy because you can't control what's going to happen. You can influence it. Like, for example, you know, they say if you exercise, maintain a healthy weight, live an active lifestyle, it actually can ward off the development of the symptoms. Or, you know, I don't know enough about it, but the doctor specifically said there's evidence of that. And so, hey, I didn't necessarily make those choices, maybe other factors, but I'm saying, like, now at least I can influence those choices for my children And that's huge.
I think to repackage what you're saying, I agree with what your doctor is saying, but for the benefit of our listeners, I will.
Please do.
I will explain it a little bit differently. We know that the genetics of HCM are the genetics of HCM. If you have the gene, there is a somewhere between 80 and 90% likelihood that at some point in your life, 0 to 80, you would develop the disease. Some don't develop it in puberty, some develop it midlife, some later life. But there's a high chance if you have the gene, it's going to happen. In the event that you do not optimize your health and you instead become obese and allow yourself to become hypertensive, get high blood pressure, if you're not exercising, if you're too sedentary, you're not supporting the rest of your cardiovascular system, which will then make the HCM appear to be worse because you're fatigued and you're drawn down because of these other disease processes. So don't create the secondary problems. Don't eat to excess. Don't drink to excess. Don't smoke to excess. Use common sense judgment and live a balanced life and teach your kids how to make healthy food choices, how to make healthy exercise choices. And it's more important within a family like ours. I have a family history. You have a family history. Many who are listening also have family history. So set people up for success. I will share an observation, and I'm going to de-identify this by switching all the factors around. A younger person in our community did need a heart transplant early. And as a reward for the surgery, the friends brought fast food to the hospital on this brand new heart. And I said to the mom, please do not encourage this behavior. You got to take care of this new heart and you don't want to give it coronary artery disease and everything else. And please stop using foods that are bad for you as a reward for good behavior. You've got to change that social dynamic that fast food is not a reward. It's a treat that we all can have once in a blue moon, but you shouldn't be living on those types of food products when you have an underlying cardiovascular disease or you've just received a transplant. So we want to be as safe and as healthy as possible and encourage our children to do so. And I agree with you that knowing is the most powerful thing we have as a family. I know who to screen. I know how to get them care. We know how to help them cope. We don't have to have our kids feeling alone in their symptoms or thinking that they're just weird or it's in their head. Mm-hmm. When my dad was a little kid, he was told he was anxious, little kid, teenager. He was told he was anxious. He was having arrhythmias. My dad wasn't diagnosed until he was like 55.
Oh, wow.
So he went through his whole life thinking he had a psychological problem when in fact he had an anatomic problem. And that affected a lot of his life and it affected my life. But I want to shine a bright light on that and get all the cobwebs out of the corner and talk about the reality that just because you have an abnormal heart doesn't mean you have to have an abnormal life. We can do well. We can take care of ourselves. We can help educate our kids. We can talk to our children differently than we were spoken to. And we can develop a better future for our kids. What do you think about that?
Couldn't have said it better. Like, for people listening to that, that's just really true. And it's like the most positive way to look at it. And it's not easy. Like, you know, me personally, like I feel like I have an unhealthy relationship with food. Like the thing about not necessarily rewarding, but looking forward to food, food centric thinking, indulging a lot in food, 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 you know, like, I would say that is a battle for me. And so I would say that resonated a lot. And I think it's important to go back to what you said is that trying to change those patterns and change that can be so powerful. Because that's like the next step, right? Like if you know, knowing is half the battle, right? And knowing how that you have a disease, accepting that you have a disease, getting your family screened for the disease. Now that knowledge is power, but it's what you do with that knowledge is how you really make an impact.
Could not agree more. Could not agree more. So in your journey, you then took this diagnosis and this path and you signed up on our inaugural ambassador round.
That's correct.
So you are one of our Big Hearted Warrior ambassadors. Tell our listeners a little bit about what it means to be an ambassador to you.
Sure. So I'm an ambassador for the HCMA. This is a wonderful program started by Lisa and Gwen Mays, who is an amazing life coach and patient as well. And she is someone who worked with you to start this program. And I was invited to be in the inaugural member list with some other key people here. And mm-hmm. I would say what's really encouraging about this is it's the HCMA is a community. It's a charity that helps people navigate the disease, whether you're a member or not. If you're a member, you can get more hands-on guidance. If you're not a member, you still have this wealth of knowledge in the website, the Facebook groups, the communities, the seminars. Like, there's so much that it's doing for the community. It's being part of a beacon and a force that's uniting people who have HCM and making an impact in the world. So that's what the HCMA does. And then the ambassador program is helping spread the word about that through different means, different demographics, different walks of life, different avenues. Like, for example, I'm a member of the e-commerce community and I'm trying to spread awareness in that community because it's a very wide and broad community with a lot of reach. And so obviously a disease like HCM, which affects 1 in 200 to 1 in 500 people, basically affects a broad spectrum of the population, not across any specific socioeconomic or ethnic lines. It's a very socialist disease in the sense that it's all people. And so I think it's a message that we can get out and spread across. So the ambassador program really allows that and for people to connect with different types of people from different walks of life. So you find an image of yourself in someone else who has the disease, which gives you the courage to go get screened, go get checked. And what I like about the ambassador program also, it's very social media driven. So I think there's a lot of people who are not currently ambassadors who might be listening or who should be encouraged to apply to become an ambassador, because so many people have a platform. And if they use that platform for good, it's just that much more personally rewarding and self-fulfilling. And so to me, that's why I'm so excited about the ambassador program, not so much because of what it does for me or how it helps me get the message out about myself, but because of what it means for the network effect and how it's creating a vector or channels or ways for more people to share their story, more people to get out there, more people to get information, because that's what's going to make the community stronger. That's what's going to make the world a better place, is if more people are stepping up. And it takes courage. You know, it's like, I'm living in public. I'm not the most like public. I'm a, you know, millennial, like someone who's right on the border. Like, I remember what it was like going to the library, but I also know social media, you know? So it's kind of like very different than just digital generation or just a pre-digital generation, even though everyone's digital now. But I just mean like, it's a very tough for me to want to be fully public with it, especially in the age of HIPAA and, you know, medical and how like discriminate, you know, like life insurance and all these other factors that are out there right now. But I would just say it's encouraging, because when you're not alone doing it, it's powerful for the world.
I think you bring up some really good points, because as you enter a disease space or you're diagnosed, you know, we're living a normal life, right? We go to work, we have houses, we got kids and animals and cars and flat tires and
responsibilities, pursuits, passions. Yep.
We're living our life, we're doing our thing, and then all of a sudden we have this new thing we have to manage along with everything else. And it always kind of reminds me of, you know, the duck paddling. He's really, the feet are going a mile a minute, but you don't see it because he looks cool on top of the water, right? We're trying to manage a lot of different aspects of life that, frankly, most of us were pretty young when we were hit with it. I remember being 22, 23 years old in my first pacemaker clinic, sitting next to 80-year-olds going, what the hell am I doing here? Like, it didn't even make sense. You find yourself in a world you didn't know anything about, a language and a vocabulary you didn't understand. And what does this mean for all the other parts of my life? And as much as we want to say that the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, provides us with protection, the world isn't always fair and honest.
You're not even necessarily allowed to feel like you have a disability, because it's an invisible disability. And like, I didn't even think of having genetic heart disease as an ADA qualification and things like that. But it's true. Like, you really are playing with one hand tied behind your back, you know, or one ventricle, you know.
One ventricle too thick. Getting through all of that is complicated. And that's why it takes a network and why it's really important to share stories from different perspectives. You know, you were a young father who was diagnosed with a considerably significant heart disease, and you've got 5 children depending upon you, a spouse depending upon you. And that brings this whole other level of stress. And we want to make that ride as easy as possible for people and help them adjust their sails and find the sources of information and support that they need through discussion groups, through webinars, through seeing a post from somebody like them, from attending their care to a center of excellence and working with their local cardiologist as well. It's complicated, but we're trying to make it as attainable and easy to understand as possible. And I am a person who used to have a disabled parking tag, and I would get dirty looks when I was using my disabled parking ticket so that I could go to the food store and get food for my family and not pass out.
Yeah, not have to walk an extra quarter mile or whatever. I mean, whatever extra walking you had to do. Yeah.
One of my most proud days was October of 2017 when my handicap pass, it expired. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to go get another one because I had had my transplant and I was feeling well enough. And I was happy to give that up. I would never look somebody cross-eyed when they're parking in a handicapped parking spot. You don't know what's going on inside. Do not judge books by covers. You will be wrong almost every time.
That's so true.
All right. Meir, thank you for sharing your perspective on your HCM journey. Maybe we'll catch up with you later in the year on another podcast and see how things have evolved and how well you're doing. But the HCMA this year, HCM Awareness Day is February 28th. We'll be having online content all day. And on February 15th, a small group of us will be heading to Washington, D.C. to the Hill to do our very first HCMA briefing to Congress.
Wow. I'll be thinking good thoughts for that. That's amazing. And thank you for having me. And really, it was an honor to participate and happy to help in any way I can.
Looking forward to continuing the journey with you, my friend. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Tales from the Heart. Stay tuned for additional episodes. And thank you to our sponsors. You can get a complete list of sponsors at 4HCM.org, as well as see our event listing so you can find a discussion group or a webinar that might help you manage your HCM a little bit better or learn a little bit more about our community. Thanks for joining.